You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, and WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. You're listening to a talk by Michael Novick on mass mobilization and community organizing.
So let me ask some questions here and see if people want to participate in some way. I'm interested in how many people, for example, have been to a mass mobilization, let's say, more than 200 miles from their home in the last year. Raise your hand. Okay, so practically everybody here. And how many people are currently engaged in a community organizing project? Oh, quite a few. Okay, so let's hear what some of them are.
I kind of want to throw something out there. Like, when we talk about these mass mobilizations, it's something to keep in mind is how much are we alienating the people that we're fighting for because we're not including them. I mean, it's kind of like we're preaching to the choir and we're playing up to the media because we're there to, you know, basically have the, it's almost like we get together, have these big parties ourselves, and we all know what the facts are, and all we're doing is getting our message out to the media. So maybe kind of along with the same lines, you hear the phrase buy locally, maybe it should be more act locally, and that's what I hope that this workshop would be about, to really question ourselves, should we really be organizing on the same type of level with the same type of energy around the people who live near us and the organizations that we could reach out to and empower near us, instead of putting all of our energy and all of our strength and all these websites and all these books and all this talk to, like, let's go have a party once a year at some city and raise a bunch of ruckus and break things. Let's see, where should our energy really be going?
You know, I think those are very pertinent questions. And if you read the editorial that, generated this discussion, it was focused on those exact themes of, the need to sink some roots where you are, to build a movement where you are with the people. But I felt it was very important to have the preliminary understanding of what are the politics to do it with. And I do want to draw this out a little further. For example, I'm a trade union organizer as well. I represent the teachers at my school in Los Angeles. I'm part of the United Teachers Los Angeles, which is a joint affiliate of the AFT and the NEA. And we're right in the middle of a struggle over our contract. We've been working without a contract since July. The union leadership just brokered a kind of a deal, and the union is now considering whether to accept or not, whether to go on strike or not. I've been involved in struggles inside the teachers union about the questions of racism. Some of it can be dealt with by the contract, some of it not. But the teachers in Los Angeles will have to make some decisions, and the organizers within that union will have to make some decisions, and you have to have some guidelines on which to make those decisions and to do that work. And the guidelines that I have to do with racism and colonialism and the kind of education I think is valuable to have. And that's beyond the struggle over vouchers or not, or, you know, the contract or not, but it comes up. I do a lot of work around police brutality. In police brutality, this very question is a very pertinent one, because the main organizing model that's out there is the model of the October 22nd Coalition Against Stop Repression, Police Brutality, and the Criminalization of a Generation. And it is a mobilization model. It says, let's get everybody together once a year. Even if it's in every city, that's not sufficiently local in that sense, because every city has the once-a-year mobilization, and then what happens on October 23rd? And so the question is, how can we, what are the forms of direct action? Direct action is not just a method of protest. Direct action is not just the way to have a demonstration. Direct action means that you're not protesting. Direct action means you want to replace the system that exists with something else, and right now you're taking action to do that. And so there are forms of community organizing that are direct action, that say, okay, the people are directly engaged in meeting their own needs, in educating themselves, in raising their own food, in designing their own plans, in building their own houses, whatever it takes to create a different kind of society, in helping each other through hard times, whatever it is. You know, there are a lot of different things that can do. There are certain understandings we have now about the nature of reality and society that are different from the ones that went into the organizing model that, you know, created the Leninist Party. And those models have to do, for example, the idea of fractals, the idea of chaos, you know, but it exists in the form of a tapestry too. If you look at a fractal, anybody know what a fractal is? Know what I'm talking about? It's a mathematical equation that creates a pattern which is infinitely self-replicating, and if you look at, but it exists in reality. If you look at Norway, if you look at the coast of Norway to any magnification, you will see the same thing. It's like all these little bumpy, you know, ins and outs. And if you look at it just on the map, it has these bumpy ins and outs. And if you look at it with a satellite and raise it, you know, it has the same ones. If you look at any one of those little bumpy ins and outs, it's got the same pattern reproduced inside it down to the microscopic, submicroscopic. If you look at a that the right word? Where anywhere you look at it, if you break off one piece of it, it's still got the whole image inside it. Our society is like that, and it's inside us. That's part of it. That's what I'm saying about the struggle. It's not just with the bourgeoisie. It's not just with the imperial army. Because the empire exists inside you. But the same thing is true in terms of this struggle. If you pull on any thread of this tapestry, you're unraveling it. So I'm not trying to tell you what piece of the work to do, but I'm telling you how to do that work and what consciousness do you want to bring to that work and what do you want to learn from that work and how do you assess it. Again, it's what I tell my students. What are you getting out of it today? You know, it's not like the future. The future is never here. It's always today. You know, the past is gone except that we reproduce it and live it inside us. So how are we creating this alternative power? And I think it does, you know, it does involve a system of dual power. You know, if you look at the Zapatistas and other things, what was the first thing the Zapatistas did? And they did it for 10 years without anybody knowing about it. You know, eventually the Zapatistas were very media savvy and they, you know, they had internet sites and so on and so forth. But for 10 years, neither the media nor the American left nor the Mexican government knew diddly squat about the Zapatistas because the Zapatistas were very quietly organizing in clandestinity by listening to people. They did their consultas. They went to listen. You know, in the independent media workshop, you know, we talked a lot about media. And I think we talk about communication, but we don't understand what communication is. It's listening. You know, it's two ways, back and forth. And, you know, I think our image of media is we have two images. We have either the publicist, which is the corporate image, or the propagandist, which is the old left image. And neither of those are based on communication medium. They don't realize, well, what is the internet and all this stuff, and one-to-one and many-to-many, is that you don't have to follow those models. We can create new models out of our experience and that give people the ability to speak back and forth directly without intermediaries. You know, we need to understand how to do that. And we need to understand how to organize that way and how to bring to the community garden this consciousness and learn from the gardeners. You know, I learn from my students every day about what kind, you know, why they need to speak English, how to speak English, what English allows you to do and doesn't allow you to do, how English needs to change. English is changing as a language, you know. My students speak Spanglish. You know, it's not just a joke. They're changing the English language by the way they speak it. And so, again, if what we change does not change us, we're playing with blocks. But we have to make these judgments. We have to evaluate. You have to decide what somebody said at the beginning workshop I went to. The first one I went to was about, you know, how do we end the hegemony of pacifism or the nonviolence and so on. And the way we do that is by evaluating the effectiveness, the meaning, the content, the direction that we're moving in by our actions. And you have to do that. You know, nobody's going to do it for you. When you leave here, you have to think about, what am I going to do next? You know, how am I going to advance this process? How am I going to be engaged in a struggle that will bring this future, this anti-authoritarian, decolonized future nearer? How am I going to help topple the empire? Do people know the poem by Shelley about Ozymandias? Fairly famous poem, and people teach it in literature. And, you know, basically, what does it say? It says, I came upon a ruin in the desert, you know, and it was just like a platform, a pedestal, and nothing left on the pedestal but dust and ashes. And it said, I am Ozymandias, the great and powerful, you know, tremble all you who come before me. And there was nothing there, you know. And, you know, we need to learn, one of the books I do read with my students is The Wizard of Oz. And if you read that book, it's really quite fascinating because, you know, what does Oz tell you? Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. I mean, Oz is a humbug. And the great and powerful Oz, where is all his power coming from, as I say, the message at the beginning? It's coming from you. And so the cowardly lion, you know, Oz gives the cowardly lion a medal. He says, I know many generals who are not as brave as you are, but what do they have? They have... They have a medal. They want a medal. And so, and then the lion feels like, oh, wow, I want a medal. I must be brave. But it was the same lion, the cowardly. It doesn't, you know, being brave doesn't mean not feeling fear. All of us are cowards. All of us feel fear, and it's natural to feel fear. It's part of the human, it's part of the animal nature. You know, if you're a sentient being, you feel fear as part of your survival, but you have to understand how to overcome your fears. Same thing with the scarecrow. The scarecrow is the smartest one among them, but the Oz gave him a diploma. We don't need the diplomas to be smart. You know what I mean? I'll give it to you in a second. The Tin Woodman, you know, had no heart, but he was the one who was the most emotional. Oz gave him a ticker, you know. But actually, it's in you. You have it. You have the understanding. You have the wisdom. You have the courage, you know, to make this a different world. But you have to exercise it. You have to challenge yourself. In other words, if we want to go and seriously listen to the people who are engaged in struggles right now and learn from them about the questions you're talking about, I think that's what I'm trying to communicate. There is a black liberation struggle in this society. There is a Native American struggle going on in this society, and they are talking all the time. They're putting it out there on the internet. There is a Chicano-Mexicano struggle. There is a movement to reunify Mexico. There is an independent struggle for Puerto Rico. The Hawaiian sovereignty movement is on the web. They're out there. We have to listen to what they're saying. The women's movement, you know, is not only a white movement. The gay movement is not only a white movement. The anti-globalization movement is not, in fact, only a white movement. There are people all around the world of color who have created, you know, the U.S. and particularly the white left is quite late to that movement. That's the fact. We're not in the vanguard of it. We're not the most advanced forces in it. We have a lot to learn, to listen to from those people that are struggling. In your local communities, there's probably somebody like some of the people who've been here today, a few, you know, veterans of the black liberation struggle and some new ones who have some things to say if you want to listen. And you don't have to engage them personally to hear those things. You know, you can read the literature, as somebody said. And you can engage the struggles. In other words, if you're dealing with police brutality, if you're dealing with political prisoners, if you're dealing with you know, prison privatization and some of the other manifestations of the prison industrial complex, if you're dealing with you know, the fact that black people are being driven off the land right now, those are issues that will engage you and relate you and connect you to the people, other people who are in struggle. It's our obligation as the imperial power to get out. The reason that Puerto Ricans need food stamps is because the economy of Puerto Rico and the agriculture of Puerto Rico was destroyed by colonialism. If Puerto Rico was independent and was able to restore its pre-existing agricultural economy, they could feed all the Puerto Ricans. If they were part of a Caribbean initiative of independent nations in the Caribbean along with Cuba, you know, they would have an industrial base that was independent of imperialism. But they don't right now. But when Germany took over Austria, I don't know if people know about this history of World War II, but they had what was called Anschluss, a unification. They said, well, all the Germans who speak German everywhere in Europe should be part of Germany. And they, you know, marched in and took over Austria and declared it was part of Germany. And they were supposed to have a vote on whether or not to unify Austria and Germany. And the day before the Germans' army marched, only one city managed to have the vote, and they voted 97% in favor of maintaining the independence and separate existence of Austria. And then the German army marched in and took over, and then they had a plebiscite on whether Austria should be united with Germany once the German army was there, and that same town voted 95% in favor of unification with Germany. So democracy is as democracy does. If you're basing, you know, the vote or the plebiscite or the opinion of the Puerto Ricans on an existing occupation, a military occupation, destruction of the environment, destruction of the agriculture, of the sea, of the land, of the air, then the Puerto Ricans feel weak and oppressed and don't understand that that's Puerto Rico and they have their power. So that's their struggle to grasp that all that wealth is actually their wealth and all the power is their power too. It's the same struggle we have. I just want to say one other thing again about this issue of direct action. I think we have to wrap up. Looks like people are coming in for something else. So I think in terms of the community work we're doing, I think this is very important. I want to reiterate it. Both in terms of the demonstrations and in terms of the community work, what you need to think about is what is the meaning of direct action? How can you have direct action community work? For example, around the police brutality, Cop Watch is direct action. What the Black Panthers did was direct action. They took direct action to eliminate the problem of police brutality by being on the streets with cameras and guns and law books. You know, you might do with a video camera, whatever it takes to change that problem, not to create a civilian review board and get some people appointed by the mayor to look into it after somebody is brutalized. So if we're dealing with the problem of homelessness and hunger, then the direct action you would take is probably getting people organized to take some land back and to grow some food of their own. You know, I think when we think about the question is how do we then engage in the struggle? And I would reiterate again, I think that especially for the white left, that has to involve listening to the voices of oppressed people who have been a struggle for a long, long time before we came on the scene and have some pretty clear ideas about, you know, what works and what doesn't and what will be effective solidarity and what won't. Thank you. I'll just say, if you want to stay in touch, the email is up there. It's part2001@USA.net, not ORG. Oh, my gosh. Okay. USA.net. Put it up wrong. How do you like that? Or www.antiracist.org/issues.html.
That was Michael Novick of People Against Racist Terror speaking on mass mobilization and community organizing. This talk was recorded last month at the National Conference on Organized Resistance in Washington, D.C. To find out more about that annual conference, visit their website at organizedresistance.org. Self-organization can address problems from workplace snitches to capital flight. That's next.
Segregation of the Snitches, Advanced Narc Repellent by Dark Colony for the Claustrophobia Collective newsletter out of Baltimore, Maryland. Please note, the term call centers mentioned in the article refers to the outsourced telephone support centers, which I'm sure everyone is called to get tech support for their computer or microwave or cable service, etc. I felt I should offer a tidbit of information that I've stumbled across via luck and good planning. I have been reading specifically on snitches, as I am familiar with them. I work at a call center, and I will spare you the intimate details, but I will say that a small group of, quote, problem children, unquote, as we were called, have managed to somehow take over the entire floor due to a great deal of luck. I may perhaps extrapolate a bit later, but I really want to give my input on how we dealt with the snitches. In most workplaces, there are very distinct hierarchies that keep us down. Owner, general manager, assistant manager, head waiter, bartender, server, busboy, kitchen help, dish detail. It doesn't matter if you're a restaurant, a call center, or the army. In general, we've all been the proverbial dish detail. These different levels can represent the general classes at work. And in order to pull off some of the methods we have used, you most likely need to have already tricked your way into one of the higher echelons. Snitches and narcs will be somewhat mixed up amongst all of the different levels on the workplace food chain, and sabotaging their espionage is somewhat difficult when you have them at every corner. I would have never thought that this would actually work, but it actually has, and so I have to tell you, it's a great way to screw up their system. In general, snitches and narcs work alone. This is their number one weakness that you must use against them. Also, they are more likely than not socially desperate, in that most likely everyone hates them or mocks them. This is another advantageous weakness to note. Where I work, a group of friends and I decided to have meetings outside of work to develop strategic advances against the narcs. We had for so long been the goof-offs, the please fire me guys who hated their jobs. And when a stroke of luck showed us that we actually had more power than we realized, we began to stop being on the defense and start working offensively. Sure, this is work, but it is work on our own wavelength and turf in order to dismantle the evils that control us in daily life. In one of our strategic meetings, we created a list of all snitches and narcs, and all people we knew for sure weren't, and all those who we were uncertain of, and we devised a plan. On the call center floor, there was a lot of chaos due to the fact that no one really had an assigned cubicle. We began planting seeds, much like the snitches do, to our superior, that, quote, perhaps assigned seating would be better, unquote. And eventually he agreed, and we offered our methodically laid out seating chart for him, and he said, great. What we had done was recognize the different groups in our workforce. The snitches, those who were the most dangerous, were all sitting together right in front of the most narc supervisor of the lot. All the loud troublemakers were placed as far away from the snitches and supervisors as possible, hidden by a huge pillar. Those who were somewhat troublesome, but in a more quiet manner, were placed in front and behind the loud troublemakers, so as to be a shield, and also to be far enough away from superiors to appear to be working quietly. Those who we were uncertain of lined all of the rows behind the snitches. Then there were those who just did their jobs and were totally apathetic. Those, too, went behind the snitches. There were also those who were friendly to us and our ways, but declined on participation. They were the shields on the either ends of the previously mentioned quiet troublemakers. The seating arrangement was better than we had originally thought, because it wasn't 24 hours later that our first snitch was ejected from the premises by another snitch. They began to eat their own willingly. And even better, we began, quote, befriending, unquote, the snitches and talking with them and planting seeds in their heads. The other snitches are out to get you type things. We're just concerned, etc. Since that brief time ago, almost all the snitches are no longer employed here. Those who are still among the employed have shot their credibility with their masters to pieces. The narc supervisor has been surprisingly snitched on as well, and now our worst enemy has no credibility and we shine. As for our allies, we have not had one attrition or termination since the seating arrangement. Now we all sit back and watch the cannibalistic genocide of the parasitic breed of snitches in our workplace. Those who set out to oppose us are now completely contained, and the others like us serve themselves and all is well. For now. This saga is always changing, and we must adapt every day. But it strengthens us after each victorious battle, and where there was once a whole family of snitches, now there are one or two shaking vigorous fists at one another while we laugh like spectators at a Roman gladiator battle in the Colosseum. Now someone feed me some grapes. That was Segregating the Snitches, Advanced Narc Repellent by Dark Colony for the Claustrophobia Collective newsletter out of Baltimore, Maryland. You can access the Claustrophobia Collective's website by going to www.charm.net/tildeclaustro.
Though they'd like you to believe otherwise, capitalists in their capital actually contribute nothing of much use to the economy or the well-being of most people. Rather, in most cases, they take away from the resources that other people might share and use. Capital flight, the removal of capitalists and their resources from a country's economy, is often used as a threat against governments or groups who want to change conditions in a country so that there is real democracy, in other words, a nation or group that functions for the benefit of the majority of its citizens. This is an interesting article by John Yu, which was published on www.infoshop.org. It's called Capital Flight, What to Do. You've just overthrown the government. Your far-left party has just won a landslide election. Or your vast coalition of civic, labor, and religious institutions have simply decided to come together and ignore the existing government. Capitalists are fleeing your country in their private jets. Investors have pulled out all their money. Foreign banks run by capitalists suddenly decide they are no longer willing to make any loans to your rogue nation. The former dictator has packed up all his suitcases full of gold, jewels, and cash from your national treasury and is nowhere to be found. Now what? Economic collapse? Mass unemployment? Depression and starvation? No, of course not. Wealth is not to be found in currency, in the so-called precious metals, in paintings by long-dead painters. None of these are needed to survive. Wealth is found in food, in warmth, in health care, and in the things necessary to produce them. All the land is still yours. All the labor is still yours. Even factory equipment remains, despite the flight of capital, that is, the loss of things that represent wealth, but are not wealth themselves. In fact, very little has been lost, and virtually all of the productive capacity of your nation remains. All that has changed is the accounting. Your nation may still have in its treasury the remnants of the capitalist financial structure, gold, other precious metals, paper money from nations around the world. Spend it as soon as possible. Buy commodities, those things you need to survive, and buy any equipment you need to produce the goods you need. That is the real wealth to people who actually have to do the work. What happens in the rest of the world is the people of your nation are suddenly flooding it with various currencies and precious metals while snapping up real goods. The supply of these currencies and precious metals go up, while the supply of real goods goes down. These goods become more and more expensive, while money becomes more and more worthless. Thus, there is all the more reason to exchange your money as soon as possible for real goods you will need. When all the old money has been spent, you are free to live, work, and produce the things you need. Self-reliance is the only secure form of wealth. Trade with other nations can still be conducted, but do not hold on to their money. Money is mere promise of future wealth. Promises that can be broken, whether from malice or from inability to fulfill them. Exchange any money for real wealth as soon as you can. Money within your own economy should be based on real wealth. When farmers produce a bushel of grain, then let them issue a paper note representing that bushel of grain. Since that paper note can be redeemed for precisely that amount of grain, there is no inflation between the notes and the grain. These paper notes can be collected by larger farmer organizations that then reissue new notes based on a diversified index of what they produce. While the value of money issued in this way may fluctuate with respect to goods not on the index, it will not change with respect to the goods that back these paper notes. This is the first step to currency stability. However, be warned that these notes are still only as good as the institutions that issue them. Either you trust that they can always be redeemed, or you redeem them as soon as it's convenient. This is especially true of money you receive from other nations that is supposedly backed in the same way. A distance makes people bolder and less hesitant to break promises. Ultimately, however, convenience would probably mean you will place your trust in an organization of like-minded people who will help each other ensure that what you have is really what you have. Although you should make sure that there are alternatives should you decide to change your mind. People can probably be trusted when times are easy and when prosperity reigns, but when times are tough, promises are much easier to break than the laws of survival. This is what makes self-reliance of an economy important. This is why local industry and agriculture should be protected. Productive ability is the real source of wealth of the nation. However, natural disasters also occur. While the world as a whole may be fairly stable, the area around you is much more prone to random fluctuations of climate and geology. Thus, self-reliance is not the entirety of a secure economy, but merely the supporting structure. The secondary source of security is prosperity in other geographical locations. The more prosperous others are, the more likely they will come to your aid in times of trouble. The more they have to thank you for their prosperity, the more likely they will come to your aid. Again, merely being creditors to their debt is not enough. Nations are sovereign, whether anarchist or authoritarian. They can break their promises. They can ignore any legalistic claims to debt. It is the general goodwill that can be fostered between two nations or people that will be your salvation in case your own self-reliance fails. In the end, capital flight isn't really capital flight. real capital, the people, natural resources, and equipment needed to produce real goods cannot be packed up in a bag when the capitalist skips town. They will require a lot of labor if they truly want to escape with a real capital. What remains when the capitalists are gone are merely the people who are doing the work and the means to do it. And that was an article written by John Yu, Capital Flight, What to Do, published on www.infoshop.org. Dr. Angela Davis is on the faculty of the University of California and has been active in radical organizing since the 1960s. She is now focusing her attention on the issue of the prison industrial complex, especially the criminalization of a whole generation of young African Americans. She spoke in Chicago last December on the need to fight the death penalty as part of a larger struggle.
One of the reasons why the election has been so disputed and why there's such a relatively even number of votes, perhaps this has to do with the fact that the positions of the two candidates on the most burning political issues are so close as to be indistinguishable. And I say this because the theme this evening is political repression. And I want to talk a little bit about the death penalty and about the relationship between the rise of a vast prison system with connections in the corporate economy. It used to be that when an execution took place, it was news. Now, no one pays attention. Here in the state of Illinois, of course, your governor, your Republican pro-death penalty governor, issued a moratorium last January 31st. When Governor Ryan issued the moratorium here in Illinois, 13 wrongful convictions had been overturned. In other words, there had been as many death penalty cases overturned as there had been executions over the last 13 years. What I want to suggest this evening is that as important as the current campaign against the death penalty may be, it can, in fact, reverberate against us unless we conduct it within the context of understanding the relationship between capital punishment and the rise of a prison industrial complex. I say this for one because, in general, the alternative to death is proposed as what? Life sentence without possibility of parole. Now, what does this mean? It means that if we do manage to abolish the death penalty, which we should, and if we don't at the same time argue against and organize against mandatory minimums and the increasing lengthening of sentences, that there will be many, 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 many more people behind bars than there are now. Because only a small fraction of people actually charged with capital crimes receive the death penalty, right? Or they're not. Only a small percentage of people who are charged with what is conceivably a capital crime are actually charged with the possibility of a death penalty. The vast majority of people charged with possibly capital crimes don't have to go through the death penalty trial phase. So it means that it's quite possible that that whole class of people will be treated even more repressively if we don't link the two issues, the death penalty and the prison industrial complex. The question is not whether the death penalty should be abolished. The question is why we need to dismantle capital punishment. And if we can understand that question, then it might be possible to bring in another kind of abolitionism into conversation with death penalty abolitionism. Maybe we can talk about death penalty abolitionism and prison abolitionism at the same time. I mean, that's what I basically want to suggest this evening. And let me tell you why I fear that the current death penalty campaign may reverberate against us. People are learning how to say that no one should be on death row who is innocent, right? I mean, the category of innocence now is moving toward center stage. So what is fair administering of the death penalty? I mean, what is that about? What is the context within which the state should be allowed to kill anyone? I mean, what is the context of fairness and equality there? I don't know. I guess Bush was saying that the fact that they're going to kill two of the men who killed James Byrd is an example of equality, is an example of racial equality, but I have a serious problem with that. Now, this category of innocence that has moved to center stage is dangerous. It is dangerous because increasingly in popular discourse, there is an understanding that it is possible to provide scientific proof of innocence, right? And what is that scientific proof of innocence? DNA. And I'm, you know, not suggesting that Barry Scheck has not done important work, but when DNA becomes the only means with which one can establish one's innocence. So many cases don't even involve DNA. And now, as a matter of fact, I mean, I know for a fact that many prisoners are just sort of grasping at straws and want DNA tests. And DNA is not going to make a difference, regardless. Now, it seems to me that there's also an ideology of innocence that we need to examine. Because what does innocence mean? It means that there must be some correspondingly guilty people walking around. And those guilty people must be in the free world, right? And so therefore, if the innocent person is taken off death row, it must be compensated by finding the guilty person who is then is the real person who should be killed. I mean, the point that I'm making is that we need to, particularly during this period, think very deeply and critically. Because if one looks at the history of the prison system and at the history of punishment in general, capital punishment included, it seems that during virtually all moments of reform, what has ultimately happened is that the system itself has been strengthened. And I'm not suggesting that this is a comment about reform in general. I'm specifically talking about prison reform. Because as a matter of fact, the prison came about as a result of a reform movement. The Quakers proposed the prison as an alternative to the death penalty. And this is really bizarre that we got the prison, but we also got a death penalty that has become even more barbaric than it was in the 18th century or 19th century when the prison was established. We began to recognize the importance of moving from campaigns around political prisoners to an understanding of the political role of the prison in general. And as a matter of fact, during that period, I'm talking about the period which saw the assassination of George Jackson, the uprising at Attica, uprisings in prisons all over, the strike at Folsom. One of the key demands was to abolish the indeterminate sentence. At that particular time, we were campaigning against the indeterminate sentence law. Because, of course, I mean, how could a person receive a sentence ranging from 1 year to life? It was very clear that that was a repressive mechanism, a repressive punishment practice designed to force prisoners to be the model prisoner, knowing that the only hope they would ever have of leaving prison would be if they obeyed in this very authoritarian way every demand of the guards. Well, what happened was that eventually the indeterminate sentence law was abolished. And what appeared to be a victory, or what we had imagined at the time as a victory, helped to lay the basis, to lay the foundation for truth in sentencing. And for these draconian sentences, such as life without possibility of parole, or 25 years without possibility of parole, you know, not 2 to 10, but 10 years, not 1 to life, but life, not, you know, 5 to 40, but 40. And this is where we are at the moment. So I'm suggesting that as we develop our demands and as we, you know, organize our campaigns, we think very seriously about the possible repercussions. And I say this particularly in relationship to the death penalty. So maybe we ought to start thinking about radical alternatives to the capitalist system. So the question is, how can we develop a critique of the death penalty, an analysis of the death penalty, against the backdrop of some kind of opposition to global capitalism? And how can we work our understanding of the prison system into that? That we rarely think about, you know, what is happening around the world is a direct result of the profit-generating activities of corporations that are largely based in the U.S. What about the prison industrial complex? Well, first of all, we have to talk about the prison as a slave plantation, and that, as a matter of fact, the slavery and the aftermath of slavery helped to form the prison, the punishment system in this country as it is today. And when one looks at the private exploitation of prison labor, we have to connect that with the convict lease system that developed in the aftermath of the Civil War, a system that was designed to manage black labor that was had just been recently set free, right? To re-enslave free black labor. But I also think it is important to say prison industrial complex. And the reason I think it's important to say prison industrial complex is because in that way we can evoke the sinister alliances that link increasing numbers of private corporations, and not just the private corporations that are directly involved in punishment, but all of the corporations that we basically count on to produce the commodities that we use in our daily lives. So many corporations have links directly or indirectly to the process of punishment, which means that these expanding prisons are occupying a central place in the economy. And see, that is what is really scary, because it's not only about these ideological arguments about who is the criminal and who isn't. It's not only about, you know, constructing criminality in the way that it has been done racially, but it's also about making money. It's also about creating this machine in a very similar way as the military-industrial complex is still with us. I mean, even though there is no more Cold War, look at all of the weapons that are continuously being constructed. Now we're talking about globalization, right? And if you look at the way in which the prison is playing a key role in globalization, let me just give you an example. Let me give you a couple of examples. One example is this. When I visited Australia 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, I was really surprised to learn that what was then the largest women's prison in Australia was owned and operated by a company that was headquartered in Nashville, Tennessee. And, you know, I've said this many times, but I think it's really important to realize what that means, that Corrections Corporation of America, fortunately, as a result of a movement in Australia, they have a very powerful anti-prison movement there, a very powerful abolitionist movement in Australia. And that's sort of interesting because Australia was initially a penal colony, right? And so most of the white Australians who live there are descendants of convicts, right? So some of them now have taken up the issue of prison abolitionism. But I have visited prisons all over the world. I have visited prisons in, well, in Australia, but also in Brazil, in Argentina, in Sweden, in the Netherlands. As a matter of fact, every time I leave the country, I try to visit a prison. Because those are the places we never think about. You know, they are everywhere. And everywhere, they're almost the same. And that sameness is a direct result of the fact that the United States of America is responsible for the proliferation of prisons all over. And for the idea that imprisonment is the only form of punishment that matters or that works. And it doesn't work. I mean, history demonstrates that imprisonment does not work. Because there's always been this strange shift from, well, prisons work because they rehabilitate. That's what the Quakers said when they first introduced the penitentiary. And I was talking about the era of globalization, the fact that new technologies of punishment travel the globe at an incredible speed. When was the first time you heard about a supermax? You know, let's create prisons that are on permanent lockdown. So control units, security housing units, and then whole prisons, super maximum security prisons. Well, there are supermaxes increasingly in other countries as well. A country like the Netherlands, Holland, which has long had a policy of decarceration. As a matter of fact, they have tried to make sure that each year they have fewer people in prison than more. And they have a prison system that allows people to go out and work. They have what they call closed prisons. They have half-open prisons, which means that you can go home on the weekends. And then they have open prisons, which means that you go to work during the day, you come back and sleep at the prison at night, and then on the weekend you go home and they close the prison down. I mean, everybody goes home on the weekend. So, I mean, they have an interesting system there. But even in the Netherlands, they have now a new super maximum security prison. In South Africa, they have a supermax. So just as the original model of the prison traveled the globe in connection with the marketing of democracy, you know, so now these ever-increasing technologies of punishment are being marketed. It's very interesting, I often point out that Corrections Corporation of America, the private Prison Corporation was started with money from Massey Burks, the funders of Kentucky Fried Chicken. And there's a similarity between the way they approach their international marketing process, basically create the same product and market it all over the world. So just as now, you know, you can go anywhere in the world almost and you see Starbucks, right? I mean, it looks like an invasion from another planet. Wherever you go, no matter, you know, what the language, what the culture, you see Starbucks everywhere. I'm just afraid that we may find ourselves in a similar situation with the prison. That everywhere we go, that's what we see. And of course, the prison industry, I like to talk about the prison industry, because I think the prison industry produces prisoners. And it produces precisely the kinds of prisoners that will keep the whole system in perpetual motion. It not only produces prisoners in the sense that it creates the kinds of prisoners that it wants, but it creates the conditions that cause increasing numbers of people to go to prison. When the funds are siphoned off from education, and when the schools cannot be developed because so much of the money is going into corrections, then those students, instead of acquiring knowledge, are basically only discipline. Because if you have a class, I mean, if you have to teach a class of, you know, 30, 40 students, and you're told that you have to keep the students in order, what do? You use precisely the kinds of techniques that come out of managing prison populations in order to keep the students in order. And then, of course, they learn how to basically be under surveillance in that way. They learn to be disciplined, and therefore they're learning how to be prisoners. They're headed, so the schools then, precisely because they cannot develop by virtue of the fact that funds are siphoned off from education, then end up replicating a system and at the same time contributing to the growth of that system. So the prison plays a pivotal role in producing the conditions of poverty that create a perceived need for more prisons. If funds, instead of going into health care or psychological health care, go into prisons, and what happens to people who need emotional assistance or who need psychological assistance, they're put in jail. It's a perpetual machine, as Joel Dyer said. It's a perpetual prisoner machine. And the prison system, the prison itself, is a breeding ground for racism. It's a breeding ground for sexism. It's a breeding ground for homophobia. It is amazing the extent to which you can more clearly see the problems we live with in the free world. I am really concerned that we link the struggles in which we are involved. That prisoners be acknowledged. You know, what often happens is that when people begin doing work around prisoners or even the death penalty, they tend to see the people who are in prison as these sort of pitiful creatures who need their help. So there's this missionary approach. And in the process, the men and the women on death row, the men and the women in all of the prisons across the country are objectified. They are, and those who do engage in that process end up doing on another level exactly what the state is doing to people who are behind bars. So it has been important to directly involve prisoners and directly involve young people. But I do want to say that I think we're at another moment now, in terms of our campaigns against the prison industrial complex, radical movements have helped to produce a new vocabulary. 10 years ago, we wouldn't be talking about the prison industrial complex. We'd probably be talking about crime and punishment. So we're increasingly learning that we have to unhook crime and punishment, that punishment happens not primarily because of crime, but in connection with a whole range of other reasons. There are more popular representations about the death penalty and prisons. And I want to say that as the kind of resistance that we've mounted becomes increasingly legitimate, it is incumbent upon us to find ways of radicalizing that resistance. But it seems to me that if you believe in justice and equality, and perhaps also socialism, because I don't want to give that up, you know, perhaps we can say that the failure to clearly elect a president has carved out a political space that we now need to fill with our own demands. In fact, we can interpret this present moment as a message that we cannot leave our future in the hands of either candidate. We need to take it up ourselves, and regardless of who is designated what they sometimes call the leader of the free world, we need to demonstrate what it really means to engage in the practice of freedom. Thank you.
That was Professor Angela Davis speaking in Chicago last December. Thanks to Labor Express for providing the tape to us.
Have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers.